marvels and apparitions. There still remain to be considered some points which have been intentionally reserved to the end. 1. The Janus-like character of the Republic, which presents two faces, one a Hellenic state, the other a kingdom of philosophers. Connected with the latter of the two aspects are, 2. The paradoxes of the Republic, as they have been termed by Morgenstern. A. The community of property. B. Of families. C. The rule of philosophers. D. The analogy of the individual and the state, which, like some other analogies in the Republic, is carried too far. We may then proceed to consider, 3. The subject of education as conceived by Plato, bringing together in a general view the education of youth and the education of afterlife. 4. We may note further some essential differences between ancient and modern politics which are suggested by the Republic. 5. We may compare the Politicus and the Laws. 6. We may observe the influence exercised by Plato on his imitators. And 7. Take occasion to consider the nature and value of political and 8. Of religious ideals. 1. Plato expressly says that he is intending to found a Hellenic state, Book 5. Many of his regulations are characteristically Spartan, such as the prohibition of gold and silver, the common meals of the men, the military training of the youth, the gymnastic exercises of the women. The life of Sparta was the life of a camp, Laws, enforced even more rigidly in time of peace than in war. The citizens of Sparta, like Plato's, were forbidden to trade. They were to be soldiers and not shopkeepers. Nowhere else in Greece was the individual so completely subjected to the state. The time when he was to marry, the education of his children, the clothes which he was to wear, the food which he was to eat, were all prescribed by law. Some of the best enactments in the Republic, such as the reverence to be paid to parents and elders, and some of the worst, such as the exposure of deformed children, are borrowed from the practice of Sparta. The encouragement of friendships between men and youths, or of men with one another, as affording incentives to bravery, is also Spartan. In Sparta, too, a nearer approach was made than in any other Greek state to equality of the sexes and to community of property. And while there was probably less of licentiousness in the sense of immorality, the tie of marriage was regarded more lightly than in the rest of Greece. The suprema lex was the preservation of the family and the interest of the state. The coarse strength of a military government was not favorable to purity and refinement, and the excessive strictness of some regulations seems to have produced a reaction. Of all Hellenes, the Spartans were most accessible to bribery. Several of the greatest of them might be described in the words of Plato as having a fierce, secret longing after gold and silver. Though not in the strict sense communists, the principle of communism was maintained among them in their division of lands, in their common meals, in their slaves, and in the free use of one another's goods. Marriage was a public institution, and the women were educated by the state, and sang and danced in public with the men. Many traditions were preserved at Sparta at the severity with which the magistrates had maintained the primitive rule of music and poetry. As in the Republic of Plato, the newfangled poet was to be expelled. Hymns to the gods, which are the only kind of music admitted into the ideal state, were the only kind which was permitted at Sparta. The Spartans, though an unpoetical race, were nevertheless lovers of poetry. They had been stirred by the elegiac strains of Tyrtaeus. They had crowded around Hippias to hear his recitals of Homer. But in this, they resembled the citizens of the timocratic rather than of the ideal state. The council of elder men also corresponds to the Spartan gerousia, and the freedom with which they are permitted to judge about matters of detail agrees with what we are told of that institution. Once more, the military rule of not spoiling the dead or offering arms at the temples, the moderation in the pursuit of enemies, the importance attached to the physical well-being of the citizens, the use of warfare for the sake of defense rather than of aggression, are features probably suggested by the spirit and practice of Sparta. To the Spartan type, the ideal state reverts in the first decline, and the character of the individual timocrat is borrowed from the Spartan citizen. The love of Lacedaemon not only affected Plato and Xenophon, but was shared by many undistinguished Athenians. There they seemed to find a principle which was wanting in their own democracy. The Greek of the Spartans attracted them, that is to say, not the goodness of their laws, but the spirit of order and loyalty which prevailed. Fascinated by the idea, citizens of Athens would imitate the Lacedaemonians in their dress and manners. They were known to the contemporaries of Plato as the persons who had their ears bruised, like the roundheads of the Commonwealth. The love of another church or country, when seen at a distance only, the longing for an imaginary simplicity in civilized times, the fond desire of a past which never has been or of a future which never will be, these are aspirations of the human mind which are often felt among ourselves. Such feelings met with a response in the Republic of Plato. But there are other features of the Platonic Republic, as, for example, the literary and philosophical education, and the grace and beauty of life, which are the reverse of Spartan. Plato wishes to give his citizens a taste of Athenian freedom as well as Lacedaemonian discipline. His individual genius is purely Athenian, although in theory he is a lover of Sparta. And he is something more than either. He has also a true Hellenic feeling. He is desirous of humanizing the wars of Hellenes against each other. He acknowledges that the Delphian god is the grand hereditary interpreter of all Hellas. The spirit of harmony and the Dorian mode are to prevail, and the whole state is to have an external beauty which is the reflex of the harmony within. But he has not yet found out the truth which he afterwards enunciated in the laws, that he was a better legislator who made men to be of one mind than he who trained them for war. The citizens, as in other Hellenic states, democratic as well as aristocratic, are really an upper class, for although no mention is made of slaves, the lower classes are allowed to fade away into the distance and are represented in the individual by the passions. Plato has no idea either of a social state in which all classes are harmonized, or of a federation of Hellas, or the world, in which different nations or states have a place. His city is equipped for war rather than for peace, and this was seen to be justified by the ordinary condition of Hellenic states. The myth of the earth-born men is an embodiment of the Orthodox tradition of Hellas, and the allusion to the four ages of the world is also sanctioned by the authority of Hesiod and the poets. Thus we see that the Republic is partly founded on the ideal of the old Greek polis, partly on the actual circumstances of Hellas in that age. Plato, like the old painters, retains the traditional form, and like them, he also has a vision of a city in the clouds. There is yet another thread which is interwoven in the texture of the work, for the Republic is not only a Dorian state, but a Pythagorean league. The way of life, which was connected with the name of Pythagoras, like the Catholic monastic orders, showed the power which the mind of an individual might exercise over his contemporaries, and may have naturally suggested to Plato the possibility of reviving such medieval institutions. The Pythagoreans, like Plato, enforced a rule of life and a moral and intellectual training. The influence ascribed to music, which to us seems exaggerated, is also a Pythagorean feature. It is not to be regarded as representing the real influence of music in the Greek world. More nearly than any other government of Hellas, the Pythagorean League of 300 was an aristocracy of virtue. For once in the history of mankind, the philosophy of order, or Greek, expressing and consequently enlisting on its side the combined endeavors of the better part of the people, obtained the management of public affairs and held possession of it for a considerable time, until about B.C. 500. Probably only in states prepared by Dorian institutions would such a league have been possible. The rulers, like Plato's Greek, were required to submit to a severe training in order to prepare the way for the education of the other members of the community. Long after the dissolution of the order, eminent Pythagoreans, such as Archytas of Tarentum, retained their political influence over the cities of Magna Graecia. There was much here that was suggestive to the kindred spirit of Plato, who had doubtless meditated deeply on the way of life of Pythagoras, Republic, and his followers. Slight traces of Pythagoreanism are to be found in the mystical number of the state, in the number which expresses the interval between the king and the tyrant, in the doctrine of transmigration, in the music of the spheres, as well as in the great, though secondary importance ascribed to mathematics in education. But as in his philosophy, so also in the form of his state, he goes far beyond the old Pythagoreans. He attempts a task really impossible, which is to unite the past of Greek history with the future of philosophy, analogous to that other impossibility which has often been the dream of Christendom, the attempt to unite the past history of Europe with the kingdom of Christ. Nothing actually existing in the world at all resembles Plato's ideal state, nor does he himself imagine that such a state is possible. This he repeats again and again. For example, in the Republic or in the Laws where, casting a glance back on the Republic, he admits that the perfect state of communism and philosophy was impossible in his own age, though still to be retained as a pattern. The same doubt is implied in the earnestness with which he argues in the Republic that ideals are none the worse because they cannot be realized in fact. And in the chorus of laughter which, like a breaking wave, will, as he anticipates, greet the mention of his proposals. Though, like other writers of fiction, he uses all his art to give reality to his inventions. When asked how the ideal polity can come into being, he answers, ironically, "When one son of a king becomes a philosopher." He designates the fiction of the earthborn men as a noble lie. And when the structure is finally complete, he fairly tells you that his republic is a vision only, which in some sense may have reality, but not in the vulgar one of a reign of philosophers upon earth. It has been said that Plato flies as well as walks, but this falls short of the truth, for he flies and walks at the same time, and is in the air and on firm ground in successive instants. Niebuhr has asked a trifling question, which may be briefly noticed in this place. Was Plato a good citizen? If by this is meant, was he loyal to Athenian institutions? He can hardly be said to be the friend of democracy. But neither is he the friend of any other existing form of government. All of them he regarded as states of faction, laws. None attained to his ideal of a voluntary rule over voluntary subjects, which seems indeed more nearly to describe democracy than any other, and the worst of them is tyranny. The truth is that the question has hardly any meaning when applied to a great philosopher whose writings are not meant for any particular age and country, but for all time and all mankind. The decline of Athenian politics was probably the motive which led Plato to frame an ideal state, and the Republic may be regarded as reflecting the departing glory of Hellas. As well might we complain of St. Augustine, whose great work, The City of God, originated in a similar motive for not being loyal to the Roman Empire. Even a nearer parallel might be afforded by the first Christians, who cannot fairly be charged with being bad citizens because, though subject to the higher powers, they were looking forward to a city which is in heaven. 2. The idea of the perfect state is full of paradox when judged of according to the ordinary notions of mankind. The paradoxes of one age have been said to become the commonplaces of the next, but the paradoxes of Plato are at least as paradoxical to us as they were to his contemporaries. The modern world has either sneered at them as absurd or denounced them as unnatural and immoral. Men have been pleased to find in Aristotle's criticisms of them the anticipation of their own good sense. The wealthy and cultivated classes have disliked and also dreaded them. They have pointed with satisfaction to the failure of efforts to realize them in practice. Yet since they are the thoughts of one of the greatest of human intelligences, and of one who had done most to elevate morality and religion, they seem to deserve a better treatment at our hands. We may have to address the public, as Plato does poetry, and assure them that we mean no harm to existing institutions. There are serious errors which have a side of truth and which therefore may fairly demand a careful consideration. There are truths mixed with error of which we may indeed say, the half is better than the whole. Yet the half may be an important contribution to the study of human nature. A. The first paradox is the community of goods, which is mentioned slightly at the end of the third book, and seemingly, as Aristotle observes, is confined to the guardians. At least, no mention is made of the other classes. But the omission is not of any real significance, and probably arises out of the plan of the work, which prevents the writer from entering into details. Aristotle censures the community of property much in the spirit of modern political economy, as tending to repress industry, and as doing away with the spirit of benevolence. Modern writers almost refuse to consider the subject, which is supposed to have been long ago settled by the common opinion of mankind. But it must be remembered that the sacredness of property is a notion far more fixed in modern than in ancient times. The world has grown older, and is therefore more conservative. Primitive society offered many examples of land held in common, either by a tribe or by a township, and such may probably have been the original form of landed tenure. Ancient legislators had invented various modes of dividing and preserving the divisions of land among the citizens. According to Aristotle, there were nations who held the land in common and divided the produce, and there were others who divided the land and stored the produce in common. The evils of debt and the inequality of property were far greater in ancient than in modern times, and the accidents to which property was subject from war or revolution or taxation or other legislative interference were also greater. All these circumstances gave property a less fixed and sacred character. The early Christians are believed to have held their property in common, and the principle is sanctioned by the words of Christ himself, and has been maintained as a counsel of perfection in almost all ages of the Church. Nor have there been wanting instances of modern enthusiasts who have made a religion of communism. In every age of religious excitement, notions like Wycliffe's Inheritance of Grace have tended to prevail. A like spirit, but fiercer and more violent, has appeared in politics. The preparation of the gospel of peace soon becomes the red flag of republicanism. We can hardly judge what effect Plato's views would have upon his own contemporaries. They would perhaps have seemed to them only an exaggeration of the Spartan commonwealth. Even modern writers would acknowledge that the right of private property is based on expediency, and may be interfered with in a variety of ways for the public good. Any other mode of vesting property which was found to be more advantageous would in time acquire the same basis of right. The most useful, in Plato's words, would be the most sacred. The lawyers and ecclesiastics of former ages would have spoken of property as a sacred institution, but they only meant by such language to oppose the greatest amount of resistance to any invasion of the rights of individuals and of the Church. When we consider the question without any fear of immediate application to practice, in the spirit of Plato's Republic, are we quite sure that the received notions of property are the best? Is the distribution of wealth, which is customary in civilized countries, the most favorable that can be conceived for the education and development of the mass of mankind? Can the spectator of all time and all existence be quite convinced that 1,000 or 2,000 years hence, great changes will not have taken place in the rights of property, or even that the very notion of property, beyond what is necessary for personal maintenance, may not have disappeared? This was a distinction familiar to Aristotle, though likely to be laughed at among ourselves. Such a change would not be greater than some other changes through which the world has passed in the transition from ancient to modern society, for example, the emancipation of the serfs in Russia, or the abolition of slavery in America and the West Indies, and not so great as the difference which separates the Eastern village community from the Western world. To accomplish such a revolution in the course of a few centuries would imply a rate of progress not more rapid than has actually taken place during the last 50 or 60 years. The Kingdom of Japan underwent more change in 5 or 6 years than Europe in 500 or 600. Many opinions and beliefs which have been cherished among ourselves quite as strongly as the sacredness of property have passed away, and the most untenable propositions respecting the right of bequests or entail have been maintained with as much fervor as the most moderate. Someone will be heard to ask whether a state of society can be final in which the interests of thousands are perilled on the life or character of a single person, and many will indulge the hope that our present condition may after all be only transitional, and may conduct to a higher, in which property, besides ministering to the enjoyment of the few, may also furnish the means of the highest culture to all, and will be a greater benefit to the public generally, and also more under the control of public authority. There may come a time when the saying, "Have I not a right to do what I will with my own?" will appear to be a barbarous relic of individualism, when the possession of a part may be a greater blessing to each and all than the possession of the whole is now to any one. Such reflections appear visionary to the eye of the practical statesman, but they are within the range of possibility to the philosopher. He can imagine that in some distant age or clime, and through the influence of some individual, the notion of common property may or might have sunk as deep into the heart of a race and have become as fixed to them as private property is to ourselves. He knows that this latter institution is not more than 4 or 5,000 years old. May not the end revert to the beginning? In our own age, even utopias affect the spirit of legislation, and an abstract idea may exercise a great influence on practical politics. The objections that would be generally urged against Plato's community of property are the old ones of Aristotle, that motives for exertion would be taken away, and that disputes would arise when each was dependent upon all. Every man would produce as little and consume as much as he liked. The experience of civilized nations has hitherto been adverse to socialism. The effort is too great for human nature. Men try to live in common, but the personal feeling is always breaking in. On the other hand, it may be doubted whether our present notion of property are not conventional, for they differ in different countries and in different states of society. We boast of an individualism which is not freedom, but rather an artificial result of the industrial state of modern Europe. The individual is nominally free, but he is also powerless in a world bound hand and foot in the chains of economic necessity. Even if we cannot expect the mass of mankind to become disinterested, at any rate, we observe in them a power of organization which 50 years ago would never have been suspected. The same forces which have revolutionized the political system of Europe may effect a similar change in the social and industrial relations of mankind. And if we suppose the influence of some good as well as neutral motives working in the community, there will be no absurdity in expecting that the mass of mankind, having power and becoming enlightened about the higher possibilities of human life, when they learn how much more is attainable for all than is at present the possession of a favored few, may pursue the common interest with an intelligence and persistency which mankind have hitherto never seen. Now that the world has once been set in motion and is no longer held fast under the tyranny of custom in ignorance, now that criticism has pierced the veil of tradition and the past no longer overpowers the present, the progress of civilization may be expected to be far greater and swifter than heretofore. Even at our present rate of speed, the point at which we may arrive in 2 or 3 generations is beyond the power of imagination to foresee. There are forces in the world which work not in an arithmetical, but in a geometrical ratio of increase. Education, to use the expression of Plato, moves like a wheel with an ever-multiplying rapidity. Nor can we say how great may be its influence when it becomes universal, when it has been inherited by many generations, when it is freed from the trammels of superstition and rightly adapted to the wants and capacities of different classes of men and women. Neither do we know how much more the cooperation of minds or of hands may be capable of accomplishing, whether in labor or in study. The resources of the natural sciences are not half developed as yet. The soil of the earth, instead of growing more barren, may become many times more fertile than hitherto. The uses of machinery far greater, and also more minute than at present. New secrets of physiology may be revealed, deeply affecting human nature in its innermost recesses. The standard of health may be raised, and the lives of men prolonged by sanitary and medical knowledge. There may be peace, there may be leisure, there may be innocent refreshments of many kinds. The ever-increasing power of locomotion may join the extremes of earth. There may be mysterious workings of the human mind, such as occur only at great crises of history. The East and the West may meet together, and all nations may contribute their thoughts and their experience to the common stock of humanity. Many other elements enter into a speculation of this kind. But it is better to make an end of them, for such reflections appear to the majority far-fetched, and to men of science, commonplace. B. Neither to the mind of Plato nor of Aristotle did the doctrine of community of property present at all the same difficulty, or appear to be the same violation of the common Hellenic sentiment as the community of wives and children. This paradox he prefaces by another proposal, that the occupations of men and women shall be the same, and that to this end they shall have a common training and education. Male and female animals have the same pursuits. Why not also the two sexes of man? But have we not here fallen into a contradiction? For we were saying that different natures should have different pursuits. How then can men and women have the same? And is not the proposal inconsistent with our notion of the division of labor? These objections are no sooner raised than answered, for, according to Plato, there is no organic difference between men and women, but only the accidental one that men beget and women bear children. Following the analogy of the other animals, he contends that all natural gifts are scattered about indifferently among both sexes, though there may be a superiority of degree on the part of the men. The objection on the score of decency to their taking part in the same gymnastic exercises is met by Plato's assertion that the existing feeling is a matter of habit. That Plato should have emancipated himself from the ideas of his own country and from the example of the East shows a wonderful independence of mind. He is conscious that women are half the human race, in some respects the more important half, laws, and for the sake both of men and women, he desires to raise the woman to a higher level of existence. He brings not sentiment, but philosophy to bear upon a question which both in ancient and modern times has been chiefly regarded in the light of custom or feeling. The Greeks had noble conceptions of womanhood in the goddesses Athena and Artemis, and in the heroines Antigone and Andromache. But these ideals had no counterpart in actual life. The Athenian woman was in no way the equal of her husband. She was not the entertainer of his guests or the mistress of his house, but only his housekeeper and the mother of his children. She took no part in military or political matters, nor is there any instance in the later ages of Greece of a woman becoming famous in literature. "Hers is the greatest glory who has the least renown among men," is the historian's conception of feminine excellence. A very different ideal of womanhood is held up by Plato to the world. She is to be the companion of the man, and to share with him in the toils of war and in the cares of government. She is to be similarly trained both in bodily and mental exercises. She is to lose, as far as possible, the incidence of maternity and the characteristics of the female sex. The modern antagonist of the equality of the sexes would argue that the differences between men and women are not confined to the single point urged by Plato, that sensibility, gentleness, grace are the qualities of women, while energy, strength, higher intelligence are to be looked for in men. And the criticism is just. The differences affect the whole nature and are not, as Plato supposes, confined to a single point. But neither can we say how far these differences are due to education and the opinions of mankind, or physically inherited from the habits and opinions of former generations. Women have been always taught, not exactly that they are slaves, but that they are in an inferior position, which is also supposed to have compensating advantages, and to this position they have conformed. It is also true that the physical form may easily change in the course of generations through the mode of life, and the weakness or delicacy, which was once a matter of opinion, may become a physical fact. The characteristics of sex vary greatly in different countries and ranks of society, and at different ages in the same individuals. Plato may have been right in denying that there was any ultimate difference in the sexes of man other than that which exists in animals, because all other differences may be conceived to disappear in other states of society, or under different circumstances of life and training. The first wave having been passed, we proceed to the second, community of wives and children. Is it possible? Is it desirable? For as Glaucon intimates, and as we far more strongly insist, great doubts may be entertained about both these points. Any free discussion of the question is impossible, and mankind are perhaps right in not allowing the ultimate basis of social life to be examined. Few of us can safely inquire into the things which nature hides, any more than we can dissect our own bodies. Still, the manner in which Plato arrived at his conclusions should be considered. For here, as Mr. Grote has remarked, is a wonderful thing, that one of the wisest and best of men should have entertained ideas of morality which are wholly at variance with our own. And if we would do Plato justice, we must examine carefully the character of his proposals. First, we may observe that the relations of the sexes supposed by him are the reverse of licentious. He seems rather to aim at an impossible strictness. Secondly, he conceives the family to be the natural enemy of the state, and he entertains a serious hope that a universal brotherhood may take the place of private interests, an aspiration which, although not justified by experience, has possessed many noble minds. On the other hand, there is no sentiment or imagination in the connections which men and women are supposed by him to form. Human beings return to the level of the animals, neither exalting to heaven nor yet abusing the natural instincts. All that world of poetry and fancy, which the passion of love has called forth in modern literature and romance, would have been banished by Plato. The arrangements of marriage in the Republic are directed to one object, the improvement of the race. In successive generations, a great development both of bodily and mental qualities might be possible. The analogy of animals tends to show that mankind can, within certain limits, receive a change of nature. And, as in animals, we should commonly choose the best for breeding, and destroy the others, so there must be a selection made of the human beings whose lives are worthy to be preserved. We start back horrified from this Platonic ideal, in the belief first that the higher feelings of humanity are far too strong to be crushed out. Secondly, that if the plan could be carried into execution, we should be poorly recompensed by improvements in the breed for the loss of the best things in life. The greatest regard for the weakest and meanest of human beings, the infant, the criminal, the insane, the idiot, truly seems to us one of the nobler results of Christianity. We have learned, though as yet imperfectly, that the individual man has an endless value in the sight of God, and that we honor him when we honor the darkened and disfigured image of him, laws. This is the lesson which Christ taught in a parable when he said, "Their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven." Such lessons are only partially realized in any age. They were foreign to the age of Plato, as they have very different degrees of strength in different countries or ages of the Christian world. To the Greek, the family was a religious and customary institution, binding the members together by a tie inferior in strength to that of friendship, and having a less solemn and sacred sound than that of country. The relationship which existed on the lower level of custom, Plato imagined that he was raising to the higher level of nature and reason, while from the modern and Christian point of view, we regard him as sanctioning murder and destroying the first principles of morality. The great error in these and similar speculations is that the difference between man and the animals is forgotten in them. The human being is regarded with the eye of a dog or bird fancier, or at best of a slave owner. The higher or human qualities are left out. The breeder of animals aims chiefly at size or speed or strength, in a few cases at courage or temper. Most often the fitness of the animal for food is the great desideratum. But mankind are not bred to be eaten, nor yet for their superiority in fighting or in running or in drawing carts. Neither does the improvement of the human race consist merely in the increase of the bones and flesh, but in the growth and enlightenment of the mind. Hence there must be a marriage of true minds as well as of bodies, of imagination and reason as well as of lusts and instincts. Men and women without feeling or imagination are justly called brutes. Yet Plato takes away these qualities and puts nothing in their place. Not even the desire of a noble offspring, since parents are not to know their own children. The most important transaction of social life, he who is the idealist philosopher converts into the most brutal. For the pair are to have no relation to one another, except at the hymeneal festival. Their children are not theirs but the state's, nor is any tie of affection to unite them. Yet here the analogy of the animals might have saved Plato from a gigantic error, if he had not lost sight of his own illustration. For the nobler sort of birds and beasts nourish and protect their offspring and are faithful to one another. An eminent physiologist thinks it worthwhile to try and place life on a physical basis. But should not life rest on the moral rather than upon the physical? The higher comes first, then the lower. First the human and rational, afterwards the animal. Yet they are not absolutely divided, and in times of sickness or moments of self-indulgence, they seem to be only different aspects of a common human nature which includes them both. Neither is the moral the limit of the physical, but the expansion and enlargement of it, the highest form which the physical is capable of receiving. As Plato would say, the body does not take care of the body, and still less of the mind, but the mind takes care of both. In all human action, not that which is common to man and the animals is the characteristic element, but that which distinguishes him from them. Even if we admit the physical basis and resolve all virtue into health of body, la façon que notre sang circule, still on mere physical grounds, we must come back to ideas. Mind and reason and duty and conscience, under these or other names, are always reappearing. There cannot be health of body without health of mind, nor health of mind without the sense of duty and the love of truth. Charmides. That the greatest of ancient philosophers should, in his regulations about marriage, have fallen into the error of separating body and mind does indeed appear surprising. Yet the wonder is not so much that Plato should have entertained ideas of morality which to our own age are revolting, but that he should have contradicted himself to an extent which is hardly credible, falling in an instant from the heaven of idealism into the crudest animalism. Rejoicing in the newly found gift of reflection, he appears to have thought out a subject about which he had better have followed the enlightened feeling of his own age. The general sentiment of Hellas was opposed to his monstrous fancy. The old poets, and in later time the tragedians, showed no want of respect for the family, on which much of their religion was based. But the example of Sparta, and perhaps in some degree the tendency to defy public opinion, seems to have misled him. He will make one family out of all the families of the state. He will select the finest specimens of men and women and breed from these only. Yet because the illusion is always returning, for the animal part of human nature will from time to time assert itself in the disguise of philosophy as well as of poetry, and also because any departure from established morality, even where this is not intended, is apt to be unsettling, it may be worthwhile to draw out a little more at length the objections to the Platonic marriage. In the first place, history shows that wherever polygamy has been largely allowed, the race has deteriorated. One man to one woman is the law of God and nature. Nearly all the civilized peoples of the world at some period before the age of written records have become monogamists, and the step when once taken has never been retraced. The exceptions occurring among Brahmins or Mohammedans or the ancient Persians are of that sort which may be said to prove the rule. The connections formed between superior and inferior races hardly ever produce a noble offspring because they are licentious, and because the children in such cases usually despise the mother and are neglected by the father who is ashamed of them. Barbarous nations, when they are introduced by Europeans to vice, die out. Polygamist peoples either import and adopt children from other countries, or dwindle in numbers, or both. Dynasties and aristocracies, which have disregarded the laws of nature, have decreased in numbers and degenerated in stature. Mariage de convenance leave their enfeebling stamp on the offspring of them, King Lear. The marriage of near relations, or the marrying in and in of the same family, tends constantly to weakness or idiocy in the children, sometimes assuming the form as they grow older of passionate licentiousness. The common prostitute rarely has any offspring. By such unmistakable evidence is the authority of morality asserted in the relations of the sexes, and so many more elements enter into this mystery than are dreamed of by Plato and some other philosophers. Recent inquirers have indeed arrived at the conclusion that among primitive tribes there existed a community of wives as of property, and that the captive taken by the spear was the only wife or slave with whom any man was permitted to call his own. The partial existence of such customs among some of the lower races of man, and the survival of peculiar ceremonies in the marriages of some civilized nations, are thought to furnish a proof of similar institutions having been once universal. There can be no question that the study of anthropology has considerably changed our views respecting the first appearance of man upon the earth. We know more about the aborigines of the world than formerly, but our increasing knowledge shows above all things how little we know. With all the helps which written monuments afford, we do but faintly realize the condition of man 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Of what his condition was when removed to a distance 200,000 or 300,000 years, when the majority of mankind were lower and nearer the animals than any tribe now existing upon the earth, we cannot even entertain conjecture. Plato, Laws, and Aristotle, Metaphysics, may have been more right than we imagine in supposing that some forms of civilization were discovered and lost several times over. If we cannot argue that all barbarism is a degraded civilization, neither can we set any limits to the depth of degradation to which the human race may sink through war, disease, or isolation. And if we are to draw inferences about the origin of marriage from the practice of barbarous nations, we should also consider the remoter analogy of the animals. Many birds and animals, especially the carnivorous, have only one mate, and the love and care of offspring, which seems to be natural, is inconsistent with the primitive theory of marriage. If we go back to an imaginary state in which men were almost animals and the companions of them, we have as much right to argue from what is animal to what is human as from the barbarous to the civilized man. The record of animal life on the globe is fragmentary. The connecting links are wanting and cannot be supplied. The record of social life is still more fragmentary and precarious. Even if we admit that our first ancestors had no such institution as marriage, still the stages by which men passed from outer barbarism to the comparative civilization of China, Assyria, and Greece, or even of the ancient Germans, are wholly unknown to us. Such speculations are apt to be unsettling, because they seem to show that an institution that was thought to be a revelation from heaven is only the growth of history and experience. We ask, what is the origin of marriage? And we are told that, like the right of property, after many wars and contests, it has gradually arisen out of the selfishness of barbarians. We stand face to face with human nature in its primitive nakedness. We are compelled to accept, not the highest, but the lowest account of the origin of human society. But, on the other hand, we may truly say that every step in human progress has been in the same direction, and that in the course of ages the idea of marriage and of the family has been more and more defined and consecrated. The civilized East is immeasurably in advance of any savage tribes. The Greeks and Romans have improved upon the East. The Christian nations have been stricter in their views of the marriage relation than any of the ancients. In this, as in so many other things, instead of looking back with regret to the past, we should look forward with hope to the future. We must consecrate that which we believe to be the most holy, and that which is the most holy will be the most useful. There is more reason for maintaining the sacredness of the marriage tie when we see the benefit of it than when we only felt a vague religious horror about the violation of it. But in all times of transition, when established beliefs are being undermined, there is a danger that in the passage from the old to the new, we may insensibly let go the moral principle, finding an excuse for listening to the voice of passion in the uncertainty of knowledge, or the fluctuations of opinion. And there are many persons in our own day who, enlightened by the study of anthropology, and fascinated by what is new and strange, some using the language of fear, others of hope, are inclined to believe that a time will come when, through the self-assertion of women or the rebellious spirit of children, by the analysis of human relations or by the force of outward circumstances, the ties of family life may be broken or greatly relaxed. They point to societies in America and elsewhere which tend to show that the destruction of the family need not necessarily involve the overthrow of all morality. Wherever we may think of such speculations, we can hardly deny that they have been more rife in this generation than in any other, and whither they are tending, who can predict? To the doubts and queries raised by these social reformers respecting the relation of the sexes and the moral nature of man, there is a sufficient answer, if any is needed. The difference about them and us is really one of fact. They are speaking of man as they wish or fancy him to be, but we are speaking of him as he is. They isolate the animal part of his nature. We regard him as a creature having many sides or aspects, moving between good and evil, striving to rise above himself and to become a little lower than the angels. We also, to use a Platonic formula, are not ignorant of the dissatisfactions and incompatibilities of family life, of the meannesses of trade, of the flatteries of one class of society by another, of the impediments which the family throws in the way of lofty aims and aspirations. But we are conscious that there are evils and dangers in the background greater still, which are not appreciated because they are either concealed or suppressed. What a condition of man would that be, in which human passions were controlled by no authority, divine or human, in which there was no shame or decency, no higher affection overcoming or sanctifying the natural instincts, but simply a rule of health. Is it for this that we are asked to throw away the civilization, which is the growth of ages? For strength and health are not the only qualities to be desired. There are the more important considerations of mind and character and soul. We know how human nature may be degraded. We do not know how, by artificial means, any improvement in the breed can be effected. The problem is a complex one, for if we go back only four steps, and these at least enter into the composition of a child, there are commonly 30 progenitors to be taken into account. Many curious facts, rarely admitting a proof, are told us respecting the inheritance of disease or character from a remote ancestor. We can trace the physical resemblances of parents and children in the same family, sic oculus, sic illimanus, sic ora therebat. But scarcely less often the differences which distinguish children both from their parents and from one another. We are told of similar mental peculiarities running in families, and again of a tendency, as in the animals, to revert to a common or original stock. But we have a difficulty in distinguishing what is a true inheritance of genius or other qualities, and what is mere imitation or the result of similar circumstances. Great men and great women have rarely had great fathers and mothers. Nothing that we know of in the circumstances of their birth or lineage will explain their appearance. Of the English poets of the last and two preceding centuries, scarcely a descendant remains. None have ever been distinguished. So deeply has nature hidden her secret, and so ridiculous is the fancy which has been entertained by some, that we might in time, by suitable marriage arrangements, or, as Plato would have said, by an ingenious system of lots, produce a Shakespeare or a Milton. Even supposing that we could breed men having the tenacity of bulldogs, or, like the Spartans, lacking the wit to run away in battle, would the world be any the better? Many of the noblest specimens of the human race have been among the weakest physically. Tertius, or Aesop, or our own Newton, would have been exposed at Sparta, and some of the fairest and strongest men and women have been among the wickedest and worst. Not by the Platonic device of uniting the strong and fair with the strong and fair, regardless of sentiment and morality, nor yet by his other device of combining dissimilar natures, statesmen, have mankind gradually passed from the brutality and licentiousness of primitive marriage to marriage Christian and civilized. Few persons would deny that we bring into the world an inheritance of mental and physical qualities derived first from our parents, or through them from some remoter ancestor, secondly from our race, thirdly from the general condition of mankind into which we are born. Nothing is commoner than the remark that so-and-so is like his father or his uncle, and an aged person may not unfrequently note a resemblance in a youth to a long-forgotten ancestor, observing that nature sometimes skips a generation. It may be true also that if we knew more about our ancestors, these similarities would be even more striking to us. Admitting the facts which are thus described in a popular way, we may, however, remark that there is no method of difference by which they can be defined or estimated, and that they constitute only a small part of each individual. The doctrine of heredity may seem to take out of our hands the conduct of our own lives, but it is the idea, not the fact, which is really terrible to us. For what we have received from our ancestors is only a fraction of what we are, or may become. The knowledge that drunkenness or insanity has been prevalent in a family may be the best safeguard against their recurrence in a future generation. The parent will be most awake to the vices or diseases in his child of which he is most sensible within himself. The whole of life may be directed to their prevention or cure. The traces of consumption may become fainter or be wholly effaced. The inherent tendency to vice or crime may be eradicated. And so heredity, from being a curse, may become a blessing. We acknowledge that in the matter of our birth, as in our nature generally, there are previous circumstances which affect us. But upon this platform of circumstances, or within this wall of necessity, we have still the power of creating a life for ourselves by the informing energy of the human will. There is another aspect of the marriage question to which Plato is a stranger. All the children born in his state are foundlings. It never occurred to him that the greater part of them, according to universal experience, would have perished. For children can only be brought up in families. There is a subtle sympathy between the mother and the child which cannot be supplied by other mothers or by strong nurses, one or more, laws. If Plato's pen was as fatal as the creche of Paris or the foundling hospital of Dublin, more than 9/10 of his children would have perished. There would have been no need to expose or put out of the way the weaker children, for they would have died of themselves. So emphatically does nature protest against the destruction of the family. What Plato had heard or seen of Sparta was applied by him in a mistaken way to his ideal commonwealth. He probably observed that both the Spartan men and women were superior in form and strength to the other Greeks, and this superiority he was disposed to attribute to the laws and customs relating to marriage. He did not consider that the desire of the noble offspring was a passion among the Spartans, or that their physical superiority was to be attributed chiefly, not to their marriage customs, but to their temperance and training. He did not reflect that Sparta was great, not in consequence of the relaxation of morality, but in spite of it, by virtue of a political principle stronger far than existed in any other Grecian state. Least of all did he observe that Sparta did not really produce the finest specimens of the Greek race. The genius, the political inspiration of Athens, the love of liberty, all that has made Greece famous with posterity, were wanting among the Spartans. They had no Themistocles, or Pericles, or Aeschylus, or Sophocles, or Socrates, or Plato. The individual was not allowed to appear above the state. The laws were fixed, and he had no business to alter or reform them. Yet whence has the progress of cities and nations arisen, if not from remarkable individuals, coming into the world we know not how, and from causes over which we have no control? Something too much may have been said in modern times of the value of individuality, but we can hardly condemn too strongly a system which, instead of fostering the scattered seeds or sparks of genius and character, tends to smother and extinguish them. Still, while condemning Plato, we must acknowledge that neither Christianity nor any other form of religion and society has hitherto been able to cope with this most difficult of social problems, and that the side from which Plato regarded it is that from which we turn away. Population is the most untamable force in the political and social world. Do we not find, especially in large cities, that the greatest hindrance to the amelioration of the poor is their improvidence in marriage? A A small fault, truly, if not involving endless consequences. There are whole countries, too, such as India or nearer home, Ireland, in which a right solution of the marriage question seems to lie at the foundation of the happiness of the community. There are too many people on a given space, or they marry too early and bring into the world a sickly and half-developed offspring, or, owing to the very conditions of their existence, they become emaciated and hand on a similar life to their descendants. But who can oppose the voice of prudence to the mightiest passions of mankind, laws, especially when they have been licensed by custom and religion? In addition to the influences of education, we seem to require some new principles of right and wrong in these matters, some force of opinion, which may indeed be already heard whispering in private, but has never affected the moral sentiments of mankind in general. We unavoidably lose sight of the principle of utility just in that action of our lives in which we have the most need of it. The influences which we can bring to bear upon this question are chiefly indirect. In a generation or two, education, immigration, improvements in agriculture and manufactures may have provided the solution. The state physician hardly likes to probe the wound. It is beyond his art, a matter which he cannot safely let alone, but which he dare not touch. We do but skin and film the ulcerous place. When again in private life we see a whole family one by one dropping into the grave under the ate of some inherited malady, and the parents perhaps surviving them, do our minds ever go back silently to that day 25 or 30 years before, on which under the fairest auspices, amid the rejoicings of friends and acquaintances, a bride and bridegroom joined hands with one another? In making such a reflection, we are not opposing physical considerations to moral, but moral to physical. We are seeking to make the voice of reason heard, which drives us back from the extravagance of sentimentalism on common sense. The late Dr. Coombe is said by his biographer to have resisted the temptation to marriage, because he knew that he was subject to hereditary consumption. One who deserved to be called a man of genius, a friend of my youth, was in the habit of wearing a black ribbon on his wrist, in order to remind him that, being liable to outbreaks of insanity, he must not give way to the natural impulses of affection. He died unmarried in a lunatic asylum. These two little facts suggest the reflection that a very few persons have done from a sense of duty what the rest of mankind ought to have done under like circumstances, if they had allowed themselves to think of all the misery which they were about to bring into the world. If we could prevent such marriages without any violation of feeling or propriety, we clearly ought, and the prohibition in the course of time would be protected by a horror naturalis similar to that which, in all civilized ages and countries, has prevented the marriage of near relations by blood. Mankind would have been the happier if some things which are now allowed had from the beginning been denied to them. If the sanction of religion could have prohibited practices inimical to health, if sanitary principles could in early ages have been invested with a superstitious awe. But living as we do far on in the world's history, we are no longer able to stamp at once with the impress of religion a new prohibition. A free agent cannot have his fancies regulated by law, and the execution of the law would be rendered impossible owing to the uncertainty of the cases in which marriage was to be forbidden. Who can weigh virtue or even fortune against health, or moral and mental qualities against bodily? Who can measure probabilities against certainties? There has been some good as well as evil in the discipline of suffering, and there are diseases, such as consumption, which have exercised a refining and softening influence on the character. Youth is too inexperienced to balance such nice considerations. Parents do not often think of them, or think of them too late. They are at a distance and may probably be averted. Change of place, a new state of life, the interests of a home may be the cure of them. So persons vainly reason when their minds are already made up and their fortunes irrevocably linked together. Nor is there any ground for supposing that marriages are to any great extent influenced by reflections of this sort, which seem unable to make any head against the irresistible impulse of individual attachment. Lastly, no one can have observed the first rising flood of the passions in youth, the difficulty of regulating them, and the effects on the whole mind and nature which follow from them, the stimulus which is given to them by the imagination, without feeling that there is something unsatisfactory in our method of treating them. That the most important influence on human life should be wholly left to chance or shrouded in mystery, and instead of being disciplined or understood, should be required to conform only to an external standard of propriety, cannot be regarded by the philosopher as a safe or satisfactory condition of human things. And still, those who have the charge of youth may find a way by watchfulness, by affection, by the manliness and innocence of their own lives, by occasional hints, by general admonitions which everyone can apply for himself, to mitigate this terrible evil which eats out the heart of individuals and corrupts the moral sentiments of nations. In no duty towards others is there more need of reticence and self-restraint. So great is the danger, lest he who would be the counselor of another should reveal the secret prematurely, lest he should get another too much into his power, or fix the passing impression of evil by demanding the confession of it. Nor is Plato wrong in asserting that family attachments may interfere with higher aims. If there have been some who, to party, gave up what was meant for mankind, there have certainly been others who, to family, gave up what was meant for mankind or for their country. The cares of children, the necessity of procuring money for their support, the flatteries of the rich by the poor, the exclusiveness of caste, the pride of birth or wealth, the tendency of family life to divert men from the pursuit of the ideal or the heroic, are as lowering in our own age as in that of Plato. And if we prefer to look at the gentle influences of home, the development of the affections, the amenities of society, the devotion of one member of a family for the good of the others, which form one side of the picture, we must not quarrel with him, or perhaps ought rather to be grateful to him for having presented to us the reverse. Without attempting to defend Plato on grounds of morality, we may allow that there is an aspect of the world which has not unnaturally led him into error. We hardly appreciate the power which the idea of the state, like all other abstract ideas, exercised over the mind of Plato. To us, the state seems to be built up out of the family, or sometimes to be the framework in which family and social life is contained. But to Plato, in his present mood of mind, the family is only a disturbing influence which, instead of filling up, tends to disarrange the higher unity of the state. No organization is needed except a political, which, regarded from another point of view, is a military one. The state is all-sufficing for the wants of man, and, like the idea of the church in later ages, absorbs all other desires and affections. In time of war, the 1,000 citizens are to stand like a rampart impregnable against the world or the Persian host. In time of peace, the preparation for war and their duties to the state, which are also their duties to one another, take up their whole life and time. The only other interest which is allowed to them besides that of war is the interest of philosophy. When they are too old to be soldiers, they are to retire from active life and to have a second novitiate of study and contemplation. There is an element of monasticism even in Plato's communism. If he could have done without children, he might have converted his republic into a religious order. Neither in the laws, when the daylight of common sense breaks in upon him, does he retract his error. In the state of which he would be the founder, there is no marrying or giving in marriage. But because of the infirmity of mankind, he condescends to allow the law of nature to prevail. C. But Plato has an equal, or in his own estimation, even greater paradox in reserve, which is summed up in the famous text, "Until kings are philosophers, or philosophers are kings, cities will never cease from ill." And by philosophers, he explains himself to mean those who are capable of apprehending ideas, especially the idea of good. To the attainment of this higher knowledge, the second education is directed. Through a process of training, which has already made them good citizens, they are now to be made good legislators. We find, with some surprise, not unlike the feeling which Aristotle, in a well-known passage, describes the hearers of Plato's lectures as experiencing when they went to a discourse on the idea of good, expecting to be instructed in moral truths, and receive